From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
People trust you if you say, I want to make $1 million, because they know exactly what you're doing. And if you start saying, I want to make meaningful, substantive art, or I really see the arts as the equivalent of a spiritual journey or something, they're like, get out of my office.
As a teenager, Ethan Hawke had a breakout role in Dead Poets Society. Hawke's agents said they could make him into a huge star, and they were not thrilled when Hawke said he had something else in mind. Hawke tells us about pushing back against Uber agent Michael Ovitz, marching to his own drumbeat, and about directing his newest movie, Blaze, the poignant story of little-known country singer-songwriter Blaze Foley. But first on the News Banter, Disney's big gamble. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW.
Almost felt you touching me.
I am joined by my colleague in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So you had a chance to talk to Bob Iger in connection with The Hollywood Reporter's Power List. This is the top 100 powerful people as best as we can parse it right now. He's number one again. He obviously sits atop Disney, which is hugely successful in many areas, but facing some challenges. Now, one of those is the attempt to launch streaming services, including one that will challenge Netflix. And Ken Ziffrin, who's a prominent attorney in town, wrote a piece saying that the attempt to take on Netflix will cost a couple of $1 billion. Like, this will be a significant drag, I guess, on Disney's earnings for at least a couple of years. What did Bob Iger tell you about that?
He acknowledges that, and he justifies it by saying that this is part of a transition that's going to happen at every big entertainment conglomerate over the next 5 to 10 years, is they are spending big to establish a direct-to-consumer relationship. And that is code for a streaming service that bypasses traditional distribution partners, which is where most of the money is actually made off of content, is in the windowing and putting it in pay TV and international TV. They're going to slowly try to take these movies and television shows away from those platforms and put them on this Disney-branded streaming service. And that's going to cost money, and it's going to disrupt that ecosystem. And Iger essentially says they're playing the long game. They know that in order to compete with Netflix in this direct-to-consumer business, they have to stock the pond with these premium Disney content that's going to get people to pay $5, $10 a month to subscribe to this. And they have the advantage here because they have all the franchises. And you're going to see Marvel limited series on the streaming service. You're going to see a Star Wars television show on the streaming service.
Yeah. So as you point out, it's going to be very disruptive. Now, it leads to some other things. Like, first, let's start with Marvel. They haven't had that much success with Marvel on ABC. Obviously, huge success in theaters. But they are now upping their game, it sounds like. They're going to take characters like Loki and the Scarlet Witch, and they're not just going to make a TV version. They're going to make a TV version with the stars who play those characters in the movies, Tom Hiddleston and Elizabeth Olsen. That's expensive, I assume. Yet, this is what Disney clearly feels they have to do to compete on the Netflix playing field. Disney has just enviable intellectual property due to some very bold and shrewd acquisitions that Bob Iger has made. You know, Marvel, notably, and now Fox, which brings them Avatar, who they've already got theme parks attractions built around that. It will fit right in. But it felt to me in one area, at least, there's a sort of internal contradiction, which is a Star Wars TV show, because Iger, I believe, acknowledged in your interview that one of the problems with Star Wars is they tried to do too much and they tried to do it too fast. And we have seen some diminishing of the luster around Star Wars, you know, fans discontented with the movies, problems in production of the movies. He did take responsibility for pushing to do this stuff too quickly, but it also raises questions around Kathy Kennedy, who oversees Lucasfilm.
Yeah, and I think if all of the Star Wars movies had worked, if Solo had done $1 billion, he probably wouldn't have said that.
Definitely.
And would have been happy with the number of films that have come out. But because there have been a couple of creative misfires, or at least the fans have interpreted them as misfired, I think that that's where this is coming from. And he's essentially taking responsibility to be the good corporate soldier and saying, you know what, we're going to pull back a little, maybe not force a movie every year. Because if you look at the production of these Star Wars movies, they've replaced directors, they have reshot endings, you know, had to do a lot of triage on these movies. And you could argue that because of this aggressive timeline that he put in place, that's where these creators creative problems have come. Now, granted, Marvel doesn't seem to have any of these problems, and Marvel put out 3 movies in the past year. So I think that's a creative execution problem that could be traced back to some of these looming deadlines they've had.
Possibly, but when you then say, okay, let's make a bunch of Star Wars TV shows for our streaming service, you feel like, well, can you really do that right now? I'm curious to know the answer as to how soon they plan to attempt to launch a Star Wars-related show. Meanwhile, ESPN Plus, you know, ESPN has been a concern as cable is increasingly challenged. It has just announced 1 million subscribers. So did Iger seem to feel like, okay, we've got this?
You know, I think that the success or the subscriber numbers at ESPN Plus are a good thing, but ESPN is still a troubled asset, not troubled in the sense of profitability. It's among the most profitable things Disney owns. But the problems at ESPN have not gone away, and Iger acknowledges this. They are losing cable subscribers, which is putting pressure on the fact that they have spent enormous sums of money to acquire rights to broadcast sporting events. And there is a push-pull there. Yes, it's great that people are paying to get ESPN and subscribing there, but the revenue from traditional areas is going to go down, down, down. And they really have to supplement that in a way that is meaningful to them, or they're going to have to start paying less for sports rights. And we haven't seen any indication that that's going to happen in the next, you know, 5 years.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. Ethan Hawke was still a teenager when he appeared in the 1989 film Dead Poets Society. He played a shy high school student brought out of his shell by an unconventional English teacher, memorably played by Robin Williams.
A yacht.
No, not just a yacht. A barbaric yacht.
Yacht.
Come on, louder.
Yaw.
Oh, that's a mouse. Come on, louder.
Yaw.
Oh, good God, boy, yell like a man.
There it is.
Later, Hawke appeared as floundering guitarist Troy in Reality Bites, the 1994 film that became a touchstone for Generation X.
What is it that you want from me, huh? What is it? You want me to get a job on the line for the next 20 years until I'm granted leave with my gold-plated watch and my balls full of tumors because I surrendered the one thing that means to me? Well, honey, you can just exhale because it's not going to happen, not in this lifetime.
A year after that, Hawke played Jesse opposite Julie Delpy's Celine in Richard Linklater's romantic Before trilogy. It all started with Before Sunrise.
So listen, here's the deal. This is what we should do. You should get off the train with me here in Vienna and come check out the town.
What?
Come on, it'll be fun.
What would we do?
I don't know. All I know is I have to catch an Austrian Airlines flight tomorrow morning at 9:30, and I don't really have enough money for a hotel, so I was just going to walk around, and it'd be a lot more fun if you came with me.
Aside from acting in many films and plays, Hawke has directed and written screenplays and novels. He directed and co-wrote his newest film, Blaze, about the talented but largely forgotten country singer-songwriter Blaze Foley. When we sat down with Hawke, he noticed a book about former CAA super agent Michael Ovitz on my desk, and he started to reminisce about early meetings at the agency.
They were all so suspicious of my lack of ambition for what they wanted. I was an extremely ambitious person, but not for what they wanted.
You mean the fact that you had artistic aspirations at a big agency, that's like what?
When, you know, you got to understand, I was 18, 19 years old the first time I walked into Michael Ovitz's office, and they try to wow you with money. So they would talk to me about things, and I was just completely disinterested in the gamesmanship of the way to play Hollywood. Anything that needs to be played, I wanted out of that game.
Yeah.
If the game was making meaningful substantive art, then that was really exciting to me. A lot of people find that really pretentious. And it's a funny thing I needed to learn. I was like, oh, people trust you if you say, I want to make $1 million, because they know exactly what you're doing. And if you start saying, I want to make meaningful substantive art, or I really see the arts as the equivalent of a spiritual journey or something, they're like, get out of my office. You know, they're, right. They're just not interested in that. And they're deeply suspicious of it.
Well, they can't make that much of a buck off of it.
Yeah, they can't make a buck off.
I mean, the sale in those days was like, get yourself a franchise. I mean, like looking at Matt Damon, you know, Bourne.
Yeah.
And
they're always trying to convince everybody they're supposed to be part of a franchise.
Right.
And they're not wrong. If you don't make people money, you don't have creative freedom. So it's constant balance. You know, actors we're only as good as our opportunity. If you're a singer-songwriter, you're a painter, you kind of can create your own opportunity. But my work is deeply involved in a collaborative medium. It's so easy to excel in Dead Poets Society. There's this machine that's built. There's Peter Weir. There's Robin Williams. There's this team of
the
other
Disney
artists.
Machine, yeah.
Well, I wasn't even thinking of Disney. Disney sold that movie. But if you worked on that movie, we had no awareness of Disney. We had a high, high awareness of Peter Weir, his wife, Wendy, who is a costume designer. And you felt you were a part of an artistic endeavor. And, you know, first of all, we're playing parts where we're being taught about Walt Whitman and we're being taught about the Transcendentalists and we're being taught about carpe diem, grab your life. And I'm being taught it by a person who sees popular art in mystical eyes. Peter Weir saw cinema as a giant empathy generator. And you felt like you were a part of something important. You put your finger on the pulse of what it was like to contribute.
Right.
And that's real. You know, it took me years to get over that experience, meaning it didn't happen again for a really, really long time. It was a rude awakening.
You mean that movie about something?
A movie about a subject matter with a group of people who all shared a common goal. And I thought that's the way it was.
Yeah.
And you're like, no, this is the except. Norman Lloyd was on the movie. He was a member of the Mercury Theater Company and worked with Orson Welles. And he's still alive. He's in his hundreds. He's an amazing person. And he said to me there that I had no idea how special what was happening was. And I was like, hey, cool, whatever. And he's like, no, you're going to be talking about this 50 years from now.
Wow.
And I didn't believe him. I didn't know how unique it was.
So you're like 17, 18 at that point. Now you're at CAA. They're telling you, kid, you've got to want to be a star and you're going to make a gazillion dollars. And at that young age, you're not interested in being a movie star.
You know, it sounds funny hearing it out of your mouth, but I wanted to be like Peter Weir. You know, this is a very young art form, cinema. Like when you think about it compared to literature and theater and music, it's extremely
100
young.
100 years, give or take.
And it's a very easy art form, meaning it's an art form that is extremely enjoyable and doesn't require much work from the audience. Right,
right. You sit there.
You sit there, but they tell you how to feel. You know, if you read Anna Karenina, it's a lot of work.
Yes, it is.
You have to imagine, you have to do these names, you have to like kind of really put yourself there and you have to do it. And when it works its spell on you, it changes your life. And the problem with a lot of contemporary movies is TV shows and film have learned so much about how to manipulate audiences that they're robbing audiences of their own experience and multi-layered experiences, you know, because
Dead Poets, it was a Disney movie. Yeah. And Disney, I mean, they're in the middle of a big change now because they're buying Fox and figuring out streaming and all the stuff that's happening in the business. But one thing's for sure is that almost no studio would make a film like Dead Poets today.
Well, they're just making less and less dramas. They would make it if Spielberg wanted to make it or Scorsese wanted to make it or something. It's the exception. And so for me, it's interesting because I want to be a dramatic actor, right? I'm not a comedian. I'm not an action star. I want to be a dramatic actor. And you feel less and less movies like that being made.
Right. I mean, even coming out of the gate, though, you're getting this big line about how to go about becoming this movie star. And that's not, you want to do artistic work, important work.
Well, I was always allergic to the word important.
Okay, meaningful.
Yeah, important.
I knew when I was saying important.
Yeah,
don't
important
go there.
Makes me roll my eyes. Anybody who says this is an important film, right, I just want to, I want to like, you know, put a pie in their face.
I'm going
or something.
To meaningful.
Yeah. I like art and music where somebody shoots from their heart. And if they have the brains to accompany it and do it well, it's not important. It's just true. I remember the first time I saw Dazed and Confused, you know, nobody would call that important work, but it actually is.
Mm-hmm.
I remember walking out of the movie theater and thinking, you know, Anton Chekhov would love this movie. You know, Chekhov always
There's
talked about his plays as comedies.
Right.
You know, we're so stupid. We're such idiots. And if you love us, you know, that movie, Dazed, has such love for the absolute idiocy of mankind. And I enjoy being around that.
That's the beauty of Rick Linklater's work, right? Mm-hmm. He sort of loves his adorable idiots.
And you realize when you watch it how often movies roll their eyes at humanity. Even really good filmmakers often think they're much smarter than their characters. You feel it, mm-hmm. you know? All I'm trying to say is that when I was a kid, I wasn't trying to be pretentious. I wasn't trying to like take myself serious as an artist. I was trying not to orient my life around accumulation of wealth. And that made a certain kind of person really dubious of me.
So what do? This thing is coming at you. This is the path. You know, you're a good-looking guy and you can be this. Mm-hmm. And you're like, no, thank you. And then what happens?
Well, I took my Dead Poets Society money. You know, I made like 30 grand on that movie and I made a short film. I had dropped out of college and that was very upsetting to my mother. And I had to promise her that I would take responsibility for my own education. So I started a theater company with, you know, not to be corny, but it's the spirit of Dead Poets Society, right?
Right.
It's like, let's get together and read some poems. Let's get together and make art. We wanted to produce plays by young artists. And I poured a tremendous amount of energy in that. I'm making it all sound positive. I was also very scared that acting would chew me up and spit me out. The world is full of these casualties of young people who take themselves incredibly seriously because they're famous for 5 minutes. And the next thing you know, they're like...
They're spun out on drugs and alcohol.
And it's really sad. And I was like, so I'm not going to take this dubious success seriously because I was really nervous that it would leave.
So how did you decide, I'll make this movie, but not that movie. I'll do this play and not make a movie. How do you sort through all of those choices?
You know, you make a lot of mistakes. I mean, you know, that's just the bottom line is you follow friends and sometimes a healthy compromise is a good idea. And sometimes it's a bad idea. So I tried to follow my nose. I really do. At 47, I feel very much like a cat. You know, I've been trying to stay alive. And, you know, I'm jealous that Matt Damon has that Bourne franchise. I mean, I don't mock that. First of all, he's amazing in those movies. Second of all, they allow him a tremendous amount of creative freedom in the other places in his life.
Right. He can do talented Mr. Ripley.
You get to do so many things. Mm-hmm. And if you don't make people money, you get banished from the team really fast. And that falls a very old, that's like the Clint Eastwood model. You know, you hear that often. Clint would do one for them, one for him. And it kept him razor sharp because of that. And that's a neat idea. I have never been so commercially successful that I could even do that. My thing is I want to work with talented people and be in the room with talented. If that's Julie Delpy, then put me in the room. If that's Sally Hawkins, if that's Denzel Washington, put me in the room. If that's Richard Linklater, put me in the room. If that's Tom Stoppard, go. You know, and so I kind of don't care if it's theater or movies. I know that when you're around, if you're in a rehearsal room with Sam Shepard, you don't want to be anywhere else.
Coming up after a short break, Ethan Hawke explains why he told musician and first-time actor Ben Dickey, who plays Blaze Foley in Hawke's new movie, that he wasn't filming him when he was. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to actor and filmmaker Ethan Hawke about his new movie, Blaze. The film follows the gifted but little-known singer-songwriter Blaze Foley. An associate of Townes Van Zandt, Foley wrote songs that were covered by more famous artists, including Merle Haggard and John Prine. Foley had his demons. Though his drinking wasn't what killed him, it ruined relationships and his shot at a promising record deal. In 1998, Lucinda Williams wrote a song about him. It was called Drunken Angel.
Drunken angel, you're on the other side. Drunken angel.
Hawke's film is based in part on a memoir written by Foley's one-time wife, Sybil Rosen. Musician Ben Dickey plays Foley, while Alia Shawkat plays Rosen. Early in the film, the couple are living in an artist's colony in Georgia, but Rosen knows they'll have to leave this paradise if Blaze wants to hit it big.
I don't want to be a star. I want to be a legend.
Well, what's the difference, Debbie?
Well, stars burn out because they shine for themselves. Look at me shine, look at me glow. I'm amazing. Legend lasts forever.
Well, so a lot of the stuff you've been talking about, you know, relates a lot to Blaze.
It does, yeah. I see us going there.
The idea to make the movie, I think you had another movie that you lost the actor and there was this space.
You know, I like to work. And
I can tell.
Yeah, I like to work. And so I had the whole fall, winter cleared to prep and direct this movie. And it fell apart in my hands. And I didn't know what to do because all of a sudden I was unemployed for the foreseeable future and I didn't want to be unemployed. And I was despondent that this film had fallen apart. And my wife said to me, well, what about that film that you wanted to make about Blaze Foley? I'm like, yeah, well, I can't do it right now. And she was like, why not? I said, because there's no script. She said, well, just write it, Ethan. Just I said, well, no, I won't write it in time to make it right now. She said, why not? Try. And so it started. I'd had this memoir, Living in the Woods in a Tree by Sybil Rosen. And I dug into the memoir and I would call her up and I pieced together a film that I was trying to make.
Did you seek her out because you wanted to do this?
I had already sought her out. You know, I was the movie I was planning to do maybe after the one I, you know, right. Someday. It was on the 5-year plan.
Right.
And I called her up. I said, this just got taken from the back burner to the front fire. We're doing this right now. And so the movie business is a little bit like this. Sometimes doors will not open. And then other times you feel compelled, pulled almost, and doors keep opening. You'd think it'd be impossible to get a movie about a guy no one's ever heard of, starring a guy nobody's ever heard of, made. But for whatever reason, the universe just kept saying yes to this project.
Well, what part of the universe said yes to the money?
My wife.
How so?
Well, she said, listen, let's just decide we're making it. And if we have to make it for $150,000, we'll make it for $150,000. Let's just decide we're making it. And we did. And not to be corny, but it does fall into that category, if you build it, they will come.
Yeah.
Kind of theory of life. The joke was the movie's made with duct tape and love, right?
Right.
You know, there was a guy, Jake Seal, who had produced Born to Be Blue. And I knew he had this little studio that he was starting in Louisiana. And once I realized I couldn't shoot the movie in Texas, I thought—
Because—
Oh, it's just impossible. You know, a couple $100,000 doesn't go far in Texas. Now, it used to, but it doesn't anymore. But Louisiana and New Mexico are very film friendly.
Yes.
Yeah. And so I called Jake. I called him up and said, would you want to do it? And he said, hell yeah. And so we partnered up. And then good things just started happening.
I mean, what made you say Blaze, this guy? Blaze Foley. Is it the thing of his ambivalence about what he wanted to be and his desire to be a pure artist versus becoming known and successful? I mean, that's the struggle in the movie, right?
It's one of the struggles in the movie. And the honest answer is that it was a lot more organic than that. It wasn't an intellectual idea. Ben has been my friend for a long time. I was a fan of his band. He had his band in Philly called Blood Feathers. And we became friends and slowly, I watched the music business like punch him in the face over and over and over again. And one night, it was New Year's Eve, 2015, and the Blood Feathers had finally given up and broken up. It was a really, really powerfully sad time for Ben. And 10 years earlier, he taught me about who Blaze Foley was. And so that night, I said to him, remember Blaze Foley? Meaning, come on, just because the business is kicking your ass doesn't mean your ass is kicked. So anyway, he picked up my guitar and he started playing Clay Pigeons. And I looked at him and he has this big, long red beard and he's from Arkansas and he's 6'5" and he looks just like Blaze Foley. And I was like, damn it, you should play Blaze Foley in a movie. And it was like that the idea happened. Then the things that you just talked about started happening. I mean, I started thinking about, well, what would a movie about Blaze Foley be about? And the ideas started seeming better and better to me. Like, wow, every biopic I've ever seen is about somebody famous. Wouldn't it be amazing to make a biopic about somebody nobody's? That would be more true to most people's artistic experience. And then we could make a movie not about a deification of an individual, but about the blazes of the world. And, you know, movies love an intersection. And I knew that Ben, you know, you watch two cars crash and where you don't know what's going to happen and the sparks fly. That's very exciting to the camera. And Ben had never acted before, but I knew this was a deeply soulful, intelligent artist sitting on top of a well of emotions about music. And he had something to say about Blaze Foley that was not going to be, quote unquote, acting. It was going to be a performance.
And then Aaliyah Shawkat comes in?
Aaliyah Shawkat came to the picture when we started writing, and I didn't know who to cast. And I came home from work one day, and my wife was like, I found her. And I said, well, okay. And she'd made all these links of different performing, because I don't really watch television. And so my wife got all these different, like, of her favorite scenes of Aaliyah's, you know, from different—
Search Party.
And— Search Party, Arrested Development, and even some of her interviews. And I was like, watch her here. Isn't she amazing? And I was like, man, she is terrific. She was working, and I was putting a lot of pressure on myself to write, and I needed to work myself, and I wanted her to come to New York, but she wouldn't come to New York, so we agreed to Skype, but I don't like to Skype, but we Skype, and there she was, and I said, listen, I don't have a script yet, but I'm making a movie about Blaze Foley. And she says, oh yeah? Clay Pigeon's my favorite song. And so I knew I'd found the perfect person, and then she believed in us. And a lot of young people wouldn't have worked with Ben. You know, they would, what do you mean a non-actor play this big part? She got it right away. Turns out she's a painter. Turns out she's a singer. And she's an adventurer. And a lot of the making of Blaze was an adventure. And you kind of had to sign up for that. Like, we did not have enough money to do what we were doing, but we were going to go get it. And so she signed on.
But then you shot Ben without telling them in the beginning.
Well, they knew I was, I called it. You got to understand, when I first asked Ben to be in this movie, he thought I was kidding, right? He said yes. And then as we got closer, I kept saying, hey, dude, you know, this is, I'm like raising money to do this. Are you in? He's like, totally, I'm in. Sounds great. I can play Blaze's songs. And the more I wrote the script, the more of a performance was going to be required. And, you know, I sent him to class. He studied with Vincent D'Onofrio, who's my favorite acting teacher. But as it got closer, you can't know the pressure it feels. When you start seeing 50, 60 adults sleeping in these little village studios in Louisiana, all because they want to make a movie about Blaze Foley, and if you don't do a good job, it's all for naught. The pressure was growing really intense on his shoulders, and he's a good person, and he loves people, and he wants to do righteously by you, you know? And I knew he was feeling the pressure, so I had to tell him the first couple days were test days, and that, you know, we're going to do all this again. I would tell him that we're just working on the camera equipment. And I would even do things like say to the DP, you like this camera? You think we should do? I don't know if I like this camera. And next time we do this, we'll do different lenses. And then he just started playing. And then he started playing with Aaliyah. And then spontaneity happens, right? And so it's not what she planned and it's not what he planned. They're not practicing their dumb line readings in the mirror. They're actually living in front of the lens. And by the time he was getting to the hard stuff of the movie, he was so relaxed. He was like, I love this, you know?
Bring my next script to me.
Yeah.
My next project.
I'm ready for Othello.
He'll end up at CAA with the meeting about being a movie star. Ethan Hawke is an actor, writer, producer, and director, and man of parts. His newest film is Blaze. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.